This is a summary of The School of Life by Elaine Bodden by bestbookbriefings.com. The School of Life, an emotional education, introduced by Elaine Bodden. Introduction, education, an individual human is not much smarter than the average animal, but as a species, we are very good at accumulating knowledge and passing it on to future generations. Through education, even the slowest human can take a few hours to learn what took a genius a lifetime to discover. In spite of this, we are incredibly selective about the topics we choose for education, focusing on material and technical subjects, while ignoring psychological and emotional ones. We are anxious about how good the next generation will be at MUT, but not on how kind they will be, or how long their relationships will last. We assume that emotional insight is unteachable, beyond reason or method, or perhaps completely unnecessary for everyday life. We are left to make our own way through our convoluted minds and act as wise as suggesting every generation rediscover the laws of physics on their own. Romanticism is a school of thought that believes reason has no place in a person's emotional life. Romanticism tells us to choose who we marry based on attraction, to choose our jobs by listening to our hearts. We are urged not to think too much, or else risk drowning out the wisdom of the heart. The results are plain to see. As a society, we have made exponential progress in technological fields, but none in the psychological. We are as clever with our machines as we are simple-minded with our emotions. In terms of our wisdom, we haven't advanced much further than the ancient Sumerians. Emotional intelligence is a strange term. We like to think of intelligence as a single capacity, but it's better understood as a range of skills aimed towards a specific set of challenges. There is mathematical intelligence, culinary intelligence, literary intelligence, and so on. There is no such thing as an entirely intelligent human being, or an entirely stupid one. We are all incredibly capable of screwing up our lives, no matter the degree of our education. When we talk about emotional intelligence, we are talking about humanistic skills: communication, introspection, empathy, generosity, and so on. Sadly, there are few disasters in history that do not ultimately stem from emotional ignorance. Self-development. As children, we are highly conscious of how quickly and intensely we are developing as humans. It's not unusual to hear a child proudly proclaim that they are 4.5 years old. But it would be insane to hear an adult to say they were 41.75. Once we're of legal age, our progress is monitored in terms of our material and professional advancement. Personal development is the same as a job promotion. But emotional growth continues. While it may not show through our appearances or our bank accounts, we can rethink our attitudes, or come to an important insight about ourselves. These milestones are real, but they usually aren't celebrated. IKRASIA, the modern educational system assumes two things about how we learn. 1. What we are taught matters much more than how we are taught it. It's the soundness of a lesson that counts, not the manner of delivery. 2. Once we understand something, it will stay in our minds for as long as is needed, like a computer's hard drive. We imagine that education can stop at a certain age, once everything necessary has been downloaded. But an emotional education requires us to rethink these assumptions. How we are taught may matter, because we tend to ignore any major, deeper truth about ourselves. Our instinct is to lash out at anyone who reveals our inadequacies. We forget almost everything we learn, and our convictions and resolutions fade like stars at the break of day. The philosophers of ancient Greece called it akrasia, or weakness of will. Akrasia is a habit of not listening to what we know should be heard, and not acting on what we know is right. Because of akrasia, we often completely understand what we should do, and yet neglect to do it. A good school shouldn't just teach us about what we've never heard of before, it should also be invested in rehearsing everything that we theoretically know, but practically forget. First world problems. Part of what prevents us from addressing our emotional problems is the belief that they are too small to be worth the bother, that we might be seen as self-indulgent by acknowledging them. But there's nothing insignificant about the problems found in the world's richest countries. While starvation and life expectancy might not be a concern, people face the extremes of loneliness, anxiety, depression burdens that culminate in exceptionally high rates of suicide. Economic growth is only worthwhile if we can address the psychological ills that appear despite, and sometimes even as a result of, abundance. The problems of the few rich countries might very well be the same problems that the rest of the world will face in a few centuries. Imperfections, the greatest enemy of satisfaction, is the belief in human perfection. We have been driven to madness by the seemingly reasonable idea that it is possible to be totally happy. But there is no perfect solution, no magical self-help book. The good news is that we are not alone with our problems. Understanding this doesn't remove the pain, but there's a comfort in knowing that everyone else is privately just as hurt and confused as us. The simple and the obscure, despite our fetish for complicated answers, many of the important truths of our emotional lives are elementally simple. In the same way, well-aimed pebble can slay a giant, simple psychological errors have the ability to ruin our lives. Simplicity is not an insult to our intelligence, but is instead a reminder of how flexible our understanding of intelligence needs to be. The school of life. School is meant to teach us the things we need to live, but more often than not, it is life that does most of the teaching. In an ideal world, all adults would recognize that they needed a continuous emotional education. There would be schools that provided classes about anger, shame, or marriage. We have left to chance some of the things we need to know the most. We have denied ourselves the chance to systematically pass on our wisdom. The difficulty of self-knowledge, we are often the last to know what is going on in our own heads. There is no shortcut for introspection, and we suffer for it. Who we are and how we feel is not a fixed location, but endlessly changing, unlimited, and unfocused. On a moment-to-moment basis, there is more data passing through us than we can ever hope to analyze. Our self-ignorance comes at a high price. Anexamine feelings remain and seep into our lives. Ambition reemerges as panic, envy curdles into bitterness, sadness into depression. Many of the things that destroy us can be traced back to emotions we never found a way to address. It makes sense that Socrates condensed the wisdom of philosophy into a single command: know yourself. Emotionalism. But he also added, I am wise not because I know, but because I know I don't know. The closer we inspect ourselves, the more we come to appreciate our flaws and our fundamental unreliability. A successful quest for self-knowledge may not give us certain, immutable facts about ourselves, but it may show us how little of ourselves we can ever truly know. Our minds play tricks on us, but we are at our most foolish when we think we aren't. The past and the present? We are all heirs of a large and complicated emotional inheritance, one that is instrumental in deciding who we are and how we behave. The way we interpret and interact with the present is influenced by expectations and assumptions we developed in the past. Primal wounds, our childhoods invariably have points in which our journey towards emotional maturity were hampered by some sort of deep psychological wound that affects us to this day. This is true for all of us, regardless of how caring or loving our parental figures were. As children, we are both physically and emotionally vulnerable, consigned to spend hundreds of thousands of hours with a limited group of people. We are intimately shaped by the bigger people around us, and out of necessity, we take what they say as the absolute truth. We are fated to be marked by their attitudes, their fears, their ambitions, their peculiarities. As a result, we lose our balance, developing strange habits and preferences. Nothing shocking or wicked needs to happen for these distortions to occur. Our primal wounds are rarely caused by anything dramatic, but their effects are never inconsequential. Imbalances. These imbalances come in all sorts and sizes. We are too timid, too aggressive, too stiff or too accommodating. We focus on material success or on no success at all. We emerge as adults, determined to rely on no one or desperate to find someone who completes us. But too often we think our attitudes are unchangeable. We believe that we are who we are, period. The truth is more hopeful, if much more uncomfortable. Our imbalances stem from a fundamental immaturity, the marks of a younger version of us's attempt to deal with something beyond them. When children suffer because of an adult, they almost always assume that something happens to them because something is wrong with them. If they are humiliated, it must be because they are stupid, disgusting, unworthy. It can take years of patient introspection to realize that perhaps the hurt wasn't deserved, and that there were a lot of other things going on in the offending adult's life, none of which were the child's fault. What makes things difficult is that our imbalances rarely ever reveal their origins so easily. We aren't sure why we run away, why we are so often angry or unreliable. We are judged by the behaviors our wounds trigger, rather than the wounds themselves. We make our lives harder when we insist on thinking of people as difficult and cruel, rather than as victims of what we all have, in one way or another, a complex early history. Self-denial, we are naturally good at lying to ourselves. We get addicted, not necessarily to hard substances, but to everyday activities like checking the news or taking on more work. Addiction is not about what we do, but how we do it, and what we do it for. We do it to distract ourselves from our dark, unsettling feelings. We lie by being relentlessly cheerful. We can't tolerate the idea that things might get sad because our background feelings are so unexplored and so potentially distressing. We lie through our cynicism. We claim that everything and everyone is terrible so that the causes of our own pain are not singled out. We lie by filling our minds with big, impressive ideas. We broadcast our intelligence to the world to hide our ignorance and confusion. We lean on what we have learned to deny what we might really need to discover. We lie by pretending we are simpler than we really are. Too much thought or psychology is nonsense, and we use common sense as a shield against our own awkward complexities. We need to be more honest with ourselves because our concealments come at too high of a price. The markers of emotional health. Self-love. When someone insults us, can we let things go? If we are in an abusive relationship, are we able to leave? Can we admit our own mistakes? At work, do we feel able to ask for the rewards we are due? Can we resist the need to please everyone? And can we say no when we need to? Candor. How much can we admit to ourselves about who we are, even when the truth is unpleasant? Do we insist on total normality, or can we explore our minds without flinching? Can we accept painful but valuable lessons? Communication. Can we express our disappointment patiently or reasonably, and enable other people to understand us? When other people upset us, do we feel like we have the right to tell them, or do we slam doors and stay silent? When they respond in a way we don't want, do we make them guess what we are too angry and panicked to explain? Trust. How ready are we for oncoming challenges? A public speech? A romantic rejection? A trip overseas? A serious illness? What do we think we are made of? If someone we love distances themselves, will they return? Do we have a shot at contentment, or must we settle? A more normal normality. Many of the things we assume to be uniquely strange or uncomfortable about us are actually totally common, if rarely spoken of in public. Any currently acceptable idea of normal is not accurate. We are all far more compulsive, nervous, sexual, vulnerable, mean, generous, thoughtful, and confused than we are encouraged to be. We know firsthand what goes on within us, but we can only know from others what they choose to show and tell, often a very edited version of the truth. The importance of a breakdown. We're experts at getting on with things. We live up to expectations and surrender to the demands of the world. Regardless of our inner struggles, we show up and get things done, and we can do this for decades without so much as a crack. Then one day, to everyone's shock, we break. We can't get out of bed. We stop talking. We refuse to eat. We do something scandalous. We poke a very big stick into the gears of daily life. Breakdowns are hugely inconvenient for everyone involved. We rush to medicate them so that business can resume, but this is a missed opportunity. A breakdown is not a random malfunction. After being ignored for so long, the emotional self is making itself heard in the only way that is left. A breakdown tells us that things can no longer continue as they are. Something has to change, or even death might be preferable. We might wonder if we have gone insane. We haven't. Beneath the agitation, we are on a hidden but logical quest for health. We haven't become sick. We were sick already. Others, the weakness of strength. Sometimes, we may wonder why annoying people are a part of our lives. We spend enough time around them that we become hyper-aware of their flaws. In times like these, we should remember the concept of the weakness of strength. People's weaknesses are the downside of certain strengths, the merits that attracted us to them in the first place. Their faults are the shadows of what are good about them. Someone's uncompromising nature might be connected to their thoroughness and honesty. Someone's messiness might be inseparable from their creativity and enthusiasm. Making connections like these can help us remember why we stay with people. Leaving to find other people is always an option, but with their strengths will always come weaknesses. To be kind is to be aware that weakness-free people do not exist. Vulnerability. We put so much effort into perfection, but ironically, failure is often what endears us to others. We all need to hear that other people have the same problems that we do. Confessing our failings comes with the risk of being ridiculed, but it's only ever this revelation that endears us to others, that turns strangers into friends. Worrying whether or not they like us, this question is at the forefront of our minds whenever we make new friends. Depending on how we answer it, we will either take steps to deepen the friendship or spare ourselves the embarrassment and withdraw. What's sad is how passive we are in regards to this question. We assume that there is a binary answer and that it's the other person's responsibility to deliver a verdict, totally separate from our own efforts. In this, we are failing to apply a basic lesson. We often don't know what we think of other people. Our moods hover and shift, with days when we can see someone's positive sides and days when we don't. What helps us decide what someone means to us is our sense of what we mean to them. A possible friendship hangs in the balance when both sides quietly wait for a sign that they are liked before showing any enthusiasm of their own. If we have a little courage, we have the chance to turn the situation in our favor. We can remember little things about them, be interested in their affairs, and sympathize with their sorrows. A relationship can only develop when one side takes a risk. The good listener. Being a good listener is one of the most important life skills a person can have. However, few of us know how to. We have not been taught, and so few of us have been sufficiently listened to. In our social lives, we are quick to speak, but slow to listen, hungry to meet, but reluctant to hear. A good listener knows that an ideal conversation goes from a state of confusion to focus, with two parties getting at the core of the matter. In reality, things don't work out that way. People tend to fight for their points instead of considering them. A good listener counters this with various techniques. They offer small, affirming remarks and gentle positive gestures like an encouraging nod or a hum to show interest. A good listener encourages their partner to go deeper into issues by saying things like, "Tell me more. And why do you think that is?" A good listener understands that any conversation will contain some amount of vagueness, but they don't rush or get impatient. They know which of their partner's thoughts are relevant to the topic at hand, and they work to align the conversation towards it. Anxiety. Anxiety is not a sign of sickness or weakness, or a problem that always demands medical attention. For the most part, anxiety is a perfectly reasonable if sensitive response to the genuine strangeness, horror, and uncertainty of existing. Anxiety is our fundamental state for many good reasons. We are incredibly vulnerable physical beings. A fragile network of organs that will eventually let us down on their own time. We make most of our major life decisions based on insufficient information. We imagine so much more than we can have, our ambition-driven, media-saturated societies encouraging envy and restlessness. We are descended from the greatest warriors of our species. Having survived violent deaths in the savannah, we carry their terror in our bones. We plan the trajectories of our careers and finances within the iron-cold, competitive, self-destructive, random apparatus of an uncontained engine of economy. We rely on the love of people we cannot control, whose needs and hopes will never completely align with our own. Anxiety comes from an overdose of clarity. Simply put, it is insight that we haven't found a use for yet, whether it be in art or philosophy. We must accept our anxieties. There's no need to be anxious about being anxious. Anxiety doesn't mean our lives have gone wrong, only that we are still alive. We must spare ourselves the extra burden of loneliness. Our suffering is far from unique. Everyone is more anxious than they would like to admit. Even the billionaire and the loving couple are in pain. Relationships. Choosing a partner. Our present understanding of love is built on freedom of choice, that we have been freed from all obstacles in order to love whoever we like. But the greatest obstacle is us. We are never completely free to love according to our wisdom or aspirations. We don't fall in love with the ones who care for us the most. We fall in love with the people who care for us the way that we expect them to. Adult love is based on a template that was created in childhood. What we're really looking for in relationships is familiarity, not happiness. What is familiar is not necessarily what is good for us. We may reject healthy and nurturing partners because they feel too right, and choose someone who will hurt us in just the right way for us to feel that we are in love. While the common advice is to simply find better people, this is easier said than done. We cannot simply re-engineer our attractions. What we can do is try to understand our partner's issues through the matured mindset of an adult, not a child. That we are a hellish proposition, in our own special ways, we are incredibly difficult people to live with. We have our flaws and distortions that will mean a lot of trouble for anyone we choose to bring into our lives. Eventually, our partner will call us out on what is wrong with us. It may feel personal, but it's just the inevitable result of spending enough time around us. The hellishness of others, the success or failure of a relationship does not depend on your partner's failings, but on how we understand them. We are not ready to enter a relationship when we have found perfection, but when we are ready to interpret another person's flaws in the kindest possible light. Our partners aren't uniquely broken. We've simply known them long enough to be familiar with all their flaws. We see that their failings don't make them unworthy of love, but instead more urgently in need of it. The longing for reassurance. No relationship is ever free from the fear of rejection. Acceptance is never fact. Reciprocating is never certain. There are always new threats, real or imagined, to the integrity of your love. But instead of asking for reassurance, we hide our needs with difficult behavior, like growing distant or controlling. We must recognize how normal it is to need reassurance, and how hard it can be to admit it. We should regularly make time in our days to ask, I really need you. Do you still want to be with me? Love and education. Our society thinks it's inappropriate to want our partners to change. The ideas that loving someone means unconditional acceptance in every area and every mistake. Any desire for change must mean something has gone terribly wrong. But the Greek idea of love supposes that a relationship should be seen as a constant opportunity for growth and improvement. The desire to correct your lover is essential and admirable. The problem is that we are terrible teachers and students. The effort required to convert criticism into sensible lessons and the humility required to listen to those lessons eludes us. When we try to teach, our voices are often hysterical and annoyed. When our attempts fail, we turn to nagging, insisting on knowledge instead of inviting it. Don't give up. Recognize that persuasion must come in terms that the other person must understand intuitively. At the same time, we must not judge flawed attempts at teaching too harshly. Rather than take it as an attack on our person, we should see it for what it is, proof that your partner cares enough to try. There is no shame in instructing or needing instruction, only in rejecting the opportunity, the wisdom of compromise. We hold in contempt couples who stay together as a compromise. Mocking these people comes in handy, emotionally speaking. We turn them into scapegoats, pinning on them the fears that we all have for our relationships, that a part of us wants to reconsider our commitments, that a certain amount of sadness and disappointment is inevitable. It is painful enough to compromise, even more to hate oneself for doing so. As a society, we should honor the ability to put up with a flawed person, to reconcile with their damage, and to accept that there may be no better way to live than with pain and longing. Work. The dangers of the good child. Good children do everything that is expected of them, and rarely ever cause trouble. We assume that they must be doing fine. But their future difficulties will come from that excessive need to please. The cautious approach they were raised with isn't enough to get them through adult life. Everything worth doing will be met with a level of strife. Even the greatest plan in the world will irritate or disappoint someone. A life built on avoiding conflict is a life of mediocrity and sterility. Proper maturity requires an honest understanding of one's own darkness, one's complexity and selfishness. One must accept that not everything that makes us happy will please others. To have a good life, 1. Must sometimes be fruitfully and bravely bad. Imposter syndrome. When faced with the idea of gaining power, responsibility, or prestige, we start to believe that we are imposters, unable and undeserving. Imposter syndrome stems from a fundamental misunderstanding of what the elite are really like. We can't imagine how flawed they truly are. We know ourselves from the inside, but we only know others from the outside. Whenever we meet a stranger, we must take a leap of faith and recognize that we are meeting someone who is not that much different from us. Nothing fundamental stands between us and the possibility of success. Fame, the fantasy of fame is as follows. Wherever you go, people will know you by your good reputation and will treat you with respect and admiration. Your happiness will become the priority of others, and you'll be the boss. But fame cannot accomplish all of these things. Fame can only guarantee that someone gets noticed a great deal more, for better, and more often for worse. The desire for fame stems from a desire for common kindness. We want to be famous because we do not feel respected, because everyday people have forgotten how to be universally civil, appreciative, and decent towards each other. The desire for fame is an indicator that normal life is not good enough. Specialization, one of the greatest struggles of work, is a sense that the job we are paid to do only engages a small part of who we are and what we can do. We are painfully conscious of our unfulfilled destinies, childhood dreams that went unrealized, or a sense that had things gone differently, we could have been something better. Our economy has a big role in this. It's simply more productive for us to focus on a specific task. The economist Adam Smith defined this as the division of labor. The success of capitalism has turned us into tiny, if relatively well-off, cogs in a giant machine. We care about our jobs because they shape who we are. Every occupation weakens or strengthens certain aspects of our personality. Certain jobs require us to be aware of the present moment or sharpen our suspicions of other people. For some careers, the path required to promotion requires being entangled with all sorts of alliances and compromises. The behavior our work requires of us will affect our entire lives, for better or for worse. Much like our relationships, we are meant to be monogamous in our work, and yet we contain more passions and talents than we will ever have the chance to explore. There is no easy solution for this angst. We carry within us many versions of ourselves that will never be given the chance to live. When we mourn them, we're not being silly or ungrateful. But we must realize that this sense of unfulfillment will follow us to whatever job we choose. Switching careers won't solve it. Higher needs, a pyramid, and capitalism. Capitalism is the greatest machine we have ever built for satisfying the needs of humanity. The last 200 years have been extraordinarily productive for our race, providing food, shelter, and entertainment. Despite this, capitalism has failed to fulfill all of our needs. Many of us are burdened by complaints, unfulfilled hopes, anger, and grief, all problems that our shops and services cannot cater to. The psychologist Abraham Maslow arranged our desires in a pyramid-shaped chart, ranging from lower needs that focused on the body to higher needs that focused on the psyche. At the very top of the pyramid, a complete development of our human potential. The world's largest corporations present a paradox. They have identified our higher needs, security, confidence, etc., and they use them to promote their material products. The pain is identified, but never soothed. We have so many complex needs and troubles that perhaps all that we can really offer ourselves is a faster car or a slightly thinner smartphone. A good future for humanity depends on expanding the scope of capitalism, on considering everything that commerce cannot cover. We need help in forming close-knit, caring communities. We need help in raising our children. We need help with discovering our real gifts in our careers and where they are most needed. Being able to structure businesses around these would be the modern-day equivalent of inventing the light bulb. We don't know what the businesses of the future will look like, but the challenge that we face now is how to narrow the gap between the fantasies on sale and what we really need to spend our lives and money on. Alain Botton is a Swiss philosopher and writer whose books on the philosophy of everyday life are bestsellers in 30 countries. Alain founded and runs a school in London called the School of Life, dedicated to fulfilling a new vision for education. Whether you prefer to read or listen, we have something for you. Visit bestbookbriefings.com now for more summaries.